Committee is called to order. Okay. So, the minutes. So, do I have a motion to move the minutes?
So moved.
So moved. So Representative Leibnick moves the meetings from Mondays, February, Thursday, February the 13th of 2020. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, so moved. So let me just explain to you guys before we get started. So if I see a little bit out of whack, it's more than normal. I have lost my keys. My keys, my ID card, my house key, my car keys, all of that. So that is halfway on my mind this morning as I try to figure out what I need to do today. So please pardon me. In saying that, we're going to move forward, though. So we have two bills before us that were mistakenly referred to this committee from the floor upon introduction. So I would like to move each of these two committees with the correct jurisdiction without recommendations. If the bills are amended at any point in a way that impacts this committee, we will request that they be re-referred back to us for further review. There are copies of both bills in your folder for your reference. You may take a look at those two bills, House File 3249 and House File 3311. Does anyone have any questions or need a moment to review the bills any further? We're going to re-refer them both.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright.
I do hope you find your keys.
Thank you.
Do we have a recollection in terms of where these are being referred to?
Yes. So, House File 3240.
I'm looking at the
You have it?
So one's going to civil law and the other one's going to early childhood?
Yes, that's correct.
And is that part of the motion then?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So the chair moves that House File 3249 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division without recommendation. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? So moved. The chair also moves that House File 3311 be re-referred to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division without recommendation. All in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? So moved. So, today we're going to have remarks from Commissioner Jody Harpstead from the Department of Human Services. This is the only agenda item today in which we will hear from the commissioner, who was appointed by the governor last August. While this is her first time addressing our committee as a body, I hope you have all had an opportunity to reach out to her individually since her appointment as well. You know, the one thing that I can say over the interim that Commissioner Harpstead has consistently kept in touch with me as a chair anyway, to just update me if there was something that was going to be in the media or something new that had arise, she would call, she had my cell number, and there was many calls. And so I really, really do appreciate Commissioner Harpstead for that effort to really keep me updated on what was going on within DHS and how she was going to help the department move forward. So I have asked the commissioner to provide us today with an update on the implementation of her 90-day plan, but quite frankly, that 90-day plan has turned into a 160-day plan, so you will get a more extensive update as to where the department is, and to let us know as a legislature, how can we be helpful partners as we work to improve the lives and experiences of Minnesotans who receives services from DHS. Once she has finished her presentation, the rest of the hearing will be a Q&A from you, from members. So please be sure to keep track of any questions that you may have during her opening remarks. And I would like to call Commissioner Hofstad to the testimony table. So welcome, Commissioner Hofstad. And before the commissioner gets started, I would just like to say, in the interest of making, wait, we'll do it afterwards. Okay, so we're going to hopefully give you at least 30 minutes to do a check-in. And once you complete that, then we will go to the members for questions. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Moran and committee members. My name is Jody Hofstad. I've served as the commissioner of the Department of Human Services now for actually 161 days. We wrote this report yesterday. So sorry that it's taken me a while to get to this committee, but you're getting more information than the other committees because we've been at it longer and we've learned more. So I appreciate the opportunity to update you on our progress. I also have to apologize in advance if I start coughing. See if we can get through this without that, but we'll see how that goes. First of all, backing up to the 90-day plan that I started the position with around Labor Day, the elements of our 90-day plan was getting to the bottom of the reported payment issues from 2019, filling open positions that we had and building a new management team, building relationships with constituents, listening and communicating with transparency, and driving the innovation in the department that has brought healthcare savings to Minnesota. Our mantra since I began was that there's nothing more important for the Minnesota Department of Human Services than to be trustworthy for the people of Minnesota. The over 1 million people we support to live in community and all taxpayers, period. I found this mission and vision statement when I arrived at the department. It's been with us for some time. The Department of Human Services, working with many others, helps people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. And the vision is that when we help each other, we create a brighter future for Minnesota. I'll let you read the values. I've had an opportunity to travel around the state and visit services that we either deliver ourselves through the Department of Human Services or support through others. It was exciting when we were able to announce the recent historic increase in MFIP for the first time in 33 years, and I had a good conversation with several beneficiaries one day who were telling me their brave and resilient stories of using MFIP just a bit to either get back into a job, to hold a job while going to school, and some people finishing that and thinking about starting businesses, grateful for the hand up that MFIP gave them so that they could get on with their lives. I recently visited the Native American Community Clinic in South Minneapolis and was pleased to see the integration of not only community services and health care, but also traditional healing approaches and very community-sensitive approaches to health care there. They're doing very good work. I visited the Wilder CCBHC, an integrated community health service in St. Paul, which has done a marvelous job of combining community services with healthcare in a way that's very grounded in their neighborhood. As Representative Moran knows, I've been actively working on the African American family preservation work. It's work I was engaged in when I was at Lutheran Social Service, and I'm still very committed to seeing what we can do to help keep families together. I had a chance to go up and give an award to the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwa for their SNAP Ed program, a program that they're using to teach people not only how to access their SNAP benefits, but to teach children how to pick out and cook with and purchase healthy food. And I've had an opportunity to observe people with disabilities these days living in host homes and in apartments and working at Byerly's grocery stores and Walgreens drug stores. So it's been a great introduction to the work of the department. I've told many people that why I came to the Department of Human Services was to see what I could do to support better health, fuller lives, and lower cost for all Minnesotans in that order, to move the needle on equity, especially racial equity. And at the time that I came, getting the department's processes and systems humming like a Swiss watch so our good people can focus on fulfilling their mission. What I found, the same quality, caring, and competent people I work with in the Minnesota nonprofit sector. Most of the DHS team would say they came to DHS to support their neighbors in living full lives, not to dot the I's and cross the T's. And some of the people at DHS love to dot I's and cross T's, and they're very good at it. They came to do their work at DHS instead of somewhere else to support their neighbors in achieving their highest potential. What I have also found about the process controls in the department is that we have a high capacity department that I would call soft around the edges. We need to sharpen our soft interdepartmental process controls to be sure service payment decisions are signed and documented by the right people. To be clear, soft, not zero. Interdepartmental, we have a lot of good decisions being made in different departments, but the interdepartmental nature of that. And our process controls, not our financial controls. We use generally accepted accounting principles and we pass our financial audits. We're talking about the payment decisions that have been made in recent years. It's my belief after being there a while that the Minnesota Department of Human Services has always operated this way. We've been addressing some issues that go back 10 to 20 years. Governor Walz hired me to clean this up and move forward with processes that we can all count on. The really good news was that DHS itself hired or trained their first Lean Six Sigma quality control green and black belts, a proven approach to tight controls back in 2011. Examples of their track record that you have perhaps witnessed, perhaps not, is turning around our own direct care and treatment programs with high quality controls, our child care investigation process. We were called over to the Department of Health to help them work on their vulnerable adult process at the Office of Health Facility Complaints. And you probably don't know that the fall MinCare re-enrollment process was as smooth as silk, because no one ever reports when something goes as smooth as silk, but it did. These are the issues, the payment issues that were raised in 2019. You've all heard about overpayments for tribal MAT, the settle-up of IMD overpayments with the counties, an overpayment to deceased beneficiaries, Minnesota Care premium refunds that needed to be made, over-recovery of cash assistance payments, the 16A and C reports, and Title IV e-funds that we're waiting for organizations to have background checks on before we can begin expending Title IV e federal funds. The total adds up to $106.5 million. And I wanted you to notice that, as Representative Moran said, you heard about the first couple in the press last year, and the rest I called the legislature to tell myself, and then I called the press myself to tell them about these issues. Because sunlight is the best disinfectant, I want to thank every one of our employees, managers, and auditors who found these issues. Each one is a trail marker pointing to another process control step that will prevent future problems. We recently released an internal audit report that you may have read a couple weeks ago of issues raised by our employees since last summer, showing detailed recommendations of additional steps we need to take to tighten controls. We're implementing every recommendation. Every dime matters. We've reported some inappropriate payments this last year. The decisions made by the Department of Human Services over many years that led to these inappropriate payments were not trustworthy decisions. I am deeply sorry to our community partners, such as tribes and counties, as well as individual Minnesotans who were affected by these decisions. At the same time, DHS is not in a free fall, not in crisis, not in total chaos. The total from the issues reported in 2019, as I said, $106.5 million over 6 years. The total DHS payments over those 6 years, $96.1 billion, so that the issues reported in 2019 add up to 0.1% of our total payments. Not our total budget, but our total payments. And we're going after the 0.1% with green and black belt Lean Six Sigma process controls because every dime matters. Around the middle of last quarter, I asked my team, we're talking about major payments back to the federal government. Does the federal government ever pay us back? As a matter of fact, yes. Recent errors for which DHS has to repay the federal government, $103.3 million. Recent items for which the federal government has had to repay DHS over the same time frame, 94 You may recall a multi-year cleanup of the Sears system for $10 million and a settlement of a BHP lawsuit in our favor for an $84 million payment from the federal government. Our payment process improvement plan started in the fall with Operation Stopgap, which our team put together knowing that we were going to need to get to work on all of this, making sure that no one wrote any checks from new payment decisions until the right signatures were on the form. And now we're under Operation Swiss Watch, which kicked off on December 3rd. Swiss Watch is a very systematic effort to look across our payment problems, get to their root cause, find the patterns between those causes, and then develop the kinds of controls that can prevent those things in the future. Excuse me. A consulting group called Public Sector Consultants is coming in to show us best practices in other states and to tell us whether there's anything we might be missing. We're currently scouring out the processes in the department, and we will find additional problems and solve them. Some early learnings that I have had from going through Operation Stopgap. We have legacy information systems that don't talk to each other, which is why we've had some of the eligibility issues. It's no surprise to me, having worked in large organizations, that the complex interactions between the giant CMS accounting system, giant DHS accounting system, and 87 county accounting and claim systems don't occasionally produce errors. We've seen errors and changes over the years in federal guidance, so we followed the guidance we were given, and it turned out to be a problem. And DHS employees and managers, however, have been embracing this new process. They're coming forward with potential risk areas for us to look into, and they're not resisting our work on Operation Swiss Watch and Operation Stopgap. We've also spent time this fall centralizing our financial controls. In October, the procurement division moved under the CFO. This area facilitates over $650 million in spending and manages over $500 million in assets. Also in October, our financial team within the healthcare administration, our largest business area, was restructured to consolidate the financial responsibilities into one person, which now also reports up through our CFO. And our financial operations division is proposing additional resources, but it already hums like a Swiss watch. As I said, we don't have problems with financial reporting, simply process control. Our compliance department jumped in with a risk assessment of their own, and initial conversations with senior leaders in each group uncovered the two biggest long-term risks, which should not surprise you, needed system upgrades, which you'll probably hear about in your entire time in the legislature, and updated process and procedure manuals. We were asked in December, what can the legislature do? A couple things. Always support additional green and black belts, compliance, financial control experts, and IT systems. We also have some proposed legislation that we've sent to the governor for his consideration. And on that list were a couple subheadings, federal compliance and program integrity. And as those come to you, if they come to you, we would ask for your help with the unexciting work of good government processes. These are not the kind of bills that are flashy, they won't impress constituents, but they're the kinds of things we all need to do to ensure good process. It would be helpful if we could factor process integrity into legislation. We hear about needing to deregulate childcare to make it more available across Minnesota, and then we hear about tight safety controls to protect children, and we're always looking for that balance together, as you are as well. PCA is another area where we want to deregulate and keep it simple, and then we hear about, but what about fraud and abuse? And so we're always looking for that balance point, and we need to look for that together. I did notice when we looked especially at those 16A forms from last year that they tend to pile up around July 1st. That's no surprise. Everything starts on July 1st. Could we pass a few bills where some things start in August or September or October so we have time to stand things up really well? And as we head into a new session and you'll have new ideas for the things the department ought to take on, there may be times when I'll say, would you like us to do these 12 new things, or should we do these 8 new things with strong process control? And there may be some trade-offs as we really start to learn what we need to do things with good process. This is Team DHS 2020. hard to read, but I'll tell you the philosophy behind it. We've cast a wide net, first looking for leadership, talent, and diversity. We have added, there it is. We have added three positions and eliminated three. At least three of our nine open positions will be filled with people of color. And I think of this chart as having sort of four circles. The one on the right, very right, is actually a line of assistant commissioners of service administrations who report directly to me. I need to learn more about each of the service administrations in the department, so I have them all reporting to me for now. On the left, we have Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson, who has all of our agency-wide administration and controls. And as you saw in previous slides, we've centralized finance, compliance, IT, and the Inspector General, and strategy and performance under him. So he has all the control processes that are where the controls will be spread across the entire department, but centralized. We also are looking to hire a Deputy Commissioner for Communications and Relations, which is the second column from the right, where we will combine our legislative work, our communications department, and our external relations under one deputy commissioner responsible for constant listening and communicating. And then I've added a chief equity officer in the center of the chart, reporting directly to me. Dr. Karen McKinney is with us to help us really look at equity across inside DHS, examine our own biases, and become interculturally more competent as we serve more and more people of color and indigenous people across Minnesota. And finally, our chief general counsel reports to me as well, and Stacy Twite has become our chief of staff. I think the structure reflects our commitments to better health, fuller life, lower costs, equity, and process control. I've asked our senior leaders to imagine their three-year biggest possibilities. It's a leadership tool I used at Lutheran Social Service. The things that we're committed to, the reason we came to the department. I asked people if you could erase your email and stop going to required meetings and just work on what you came here to do. What's the biggest possibility of that over the next 3 years? Some samples, Marshall Smith in direct care and treatment, who has gotten direct care and treatment really turned around from when it was in the blazing headlines itself 3 years ago, now wants to achieve the readiness criteria for the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. If they actually got that award, it would be, they think, the first department of a state government to win the award. Lisa Bailey in our Children and Family Services wants to capture and organize the statewide commitment to big picture reform of our child welfare system. Tom Moss, our Interim Healthcare Administration, AC, is interested in establishing Integrated Health Partnerships 2.0. And for starters, my biggest possibility is that 50% of all of our senior managers will achieve their biggest possibilities. We've also turned in a draft of our strategic plan to the governor's office in the last week. A few elements in that draft plan: healthy beginnings. We're signing up through the Children's Cabinet to reduce infant and maternal mortality across Minnesota. We're committed to using an equity review tool to evaluate every DHS service for whether it produces greater equity or at least doesn't contribute to greater inequity. We've been using that same tool on the Blue Ribbon Commission, and it's been very useful. And we're interested in integrating human services technology to make services easier to access as counties form service hubs in some of their county buildings where a person can come and get all the different services they need in one place. One of the other elements of the 90-day plan is supporting employees and building a great culture. The first key to that always is a strong management team. So we have a great mix of veterans and fresh ideas, and we're working to train great managers that people can trust. We're now working on an employee vision statement. We've long had a vision statement for the people we support, and now we're looking to have a vision statement for what it should be like to work in the Department of Human Services. And before I came, I also discovered they have this collaborative safety model that about one-third of our people have been trained on, and we're working now to train everyone. It's a process that allows you to tackle problems without tackling each other. And our goal is to be tough on process, but supportive and encouraging to our people. I mentioned that we're looking for a deputy commissioner for communications and relations who would be responsible for relationships with the legislature, counties, tribes, the federal government, communities, and the media. We are rebuilding a former DHS Tribal County Leadership Council. Serving over a million Minnesotans and spending billions in taxpayer money, I think we have a particular obligation to excel at listening and communicating. And we're developing new flexibility around discussing ideas with key partners instead of surprising them with new information. So instead of sending bulletins out to counties, we're working with tribes and counties to solve problems. And the last part of my 90-day plan was innovation, better health, fuller life, lower cost, in that order. Minnesota, of course, is already a national leader in new models like the integrated health partnerships, accountable care organizations, the incorporation of social determinants of health, the certified community behavioral health clinics, and two-generation support approaches. One result that you may not be familiar with is that Minnesota's average managed care capitation rates increased 8.3% per year from 2000 to 2010, and they decreased 5.7% per year from 2011 to 2016. We have a new procurement plan. As you have heard us announce, we're not planning to do any Medicaid healthcare contracting in 2020. All current contracts will stay in place with no disruption of coverage. Consumers of healthcare have access and plans have good rates. It gives us all a chance to discuss what Minnesotans really want in these procurements. It gives our new Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare and Medicaid Director a chance to get their feet under them. And it gives DHS a chance to launch our new process control effort. So we're planning to procure the rural children and family healthcare contracts in 2021 to start in 2022, the senior and SNBC coordination services in 2021 to start in 2022, and Metro Children and Family Health Care in 2022 to start in 23. Lessons from 2019. Most of the payment issues we're addressing now did not happen in 2019. They went viral in 2019. And we've put stopgaps in place in 2019. The confluence of DHS resignations and media coverage of tribal overpayments kicked off a frenzy that led to a view of DHS as a department in disarray. The resulting outcry caused pressure on employee relationships in the department, making it harder to get the good work done, not to mention our biggest possibilities. Democracy isn't easy. When we run billions of dollars in taxpayer money and every Minnesotan has an opinion about how that should be spent, we quickly become the department everyone loves to criticize. Fair enough, we can live with that. But I would ask Minnesotans to look at the department's overall results, read the stories of the lives supported with their tax dollars through our work, and make a fair judgment of the total picture. I've been to visit both the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter and our sex offender treatment program in Moose Lake. I am awe-inspired by the dedication of people who've spent 20 to 30 years in these services, many of them together on the same team. I am awe-inspired to their commitment to de-escalation and minimizing restraints in personally dangerous encounters. And I am awe-inspired that Minnesota supports these compassionate services. Should we break up the department? As you've heard, we're finalizing an RFP with the governor's office for a consultant with experience in other states to examine this question and tell us how other states organize human services. We and they will also study prior recommendations and spend 2020 developing a point of view with community inputs. We're eager to get our process controls in place before getting deep into this question. So there was a 90-day plan and then a 90-day report. So then what? We decided to create the DHS Commissioner's Advisory Panel 2020 to review progress and continue to advise me on restoring the trustworthiness of the department, including process controls, management team development, department culture, and transparent communications and relations. I'm delighted to say that Bill George, former Medtronic CEO, has agreed to co-chair along with Penny Wheeler, the CEO of Allina Health Systems. I'm really delighted that our four legislative chairs of our Health and Human Services committees have all agreed to serve together, And we rounded out the advisory panel with a group of community members. So I'm very eager for these conversations to take place throughout 2020 as we continue to follow up on the elements of that 90-day plan. I'm very proud to be the commissioner of the Department of Human Services. The people of the department came to DHS to support their neighbors in living in community and achieving their highest potential. We've attracted strong candidates for our open positions who are honored to be joining us. I ask for your support as we continue to work to strengthen process controls, build a strong team, strengthen relationships, and continue our innovation. I'm also very proud to be a Minnesotan, even more so since I've taken this position. In every sector in which I've worked, we all come home from national conferences thrilled to be working in Minnesota. I've learned that Minnesotans uniquely believe that we have an obligation to care for our neighbors, and if we apply ourselves, we can make things right. Minnesotans love and excel at the art of democracy. So bring on the conversation. And there's nothing more important for the Minnesota Department of Human Services than to be trustworthy for the people of Minnesota, the over 1 million people we support to live in community, and all taxpayers, period. Thank you.
But thank you so much for that thorough and insightful work that you're doing within the Department of Human Services. And I'm excited that you are excited to be the commissioner of DHS. You seem to be doing good work. So members, in the interest of making sure everybody has a chance to ask some of their questions, what I would like for us to do is to go around the room and maybe we do one question at a time per member, just to make sure that every member have time to ask a question. So let staff know if you would like to get on the list. If you have a direct follow-up question, let me know, and I will recognize you after the commissioner initial answer to your question. Okay? So if you're interested, if you have a question? Oh, no one. That's beautiful. Let's talk. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you for being here, and it's great to hear what you've been working on, and I know that the Department of Human Services is big, and you mentioned the discussion about breaking up DHS, and that's been a big conversation. I'm not even sure I support that, but I'm And I think our members are questioning it, too, whether or not we need to do that. So rather than just rearranging the chairs on the Titanic, do you have any other – can you discuss a little deeper thoughts about if we broke it up or where you're at with that breakup? Would you rather see it stay together?
Commissioner Hoxie.
Thank you, Chair Moran and Representative. I've said all along that I'm neutral on that subject. I'm open to the conversation, have been all along. The more I spend time in the department, I'm committed to a few things. I'm committed that we get our process controls in place before we get too deep into that conversation. It would take the same staff to support an effort to break up the department that it's taking now to put process controls in place. And I think we're all gonna wanna be sure that we've got this place buttoned up before we think about organization changes. So that's one thing. As we put controls in place across all of our administrations, children and family, community supports, healthcare, and older adults, it seems to me to have centralized these controls and made sure that all those administrations are using them, it'd be a shame then to break them up and have them recreate them somewhere else. So that's another thought I've had. Of course, the most common the idea that's been brought forward is the possibility of separating direct care and treatment from the rest of the department, because that's a different thing than these various administrations. And it's operating fairly well right now, having gotten some of its own process controls in place. The other most common idea that's been brought forward is the Inspector General's office. And Minnesotans have often been slightly uncomfortable by the potential conflict of interest with the Inspector General inspecting our own services. Though I've also read reports that suggest it hasn't really caused any major problems, it's a questionable kind of a design. And so that's been brought up in the past. I haven't developed a point of view yet or come to a conclusion. I have also not made the case for how we really need to break up the department. There are large organizations that can run quite well, and I think if we focus more on the process controls and get those in place, that's the really central question right now for the department. But we're still open and eager to have the consultant come in and tell us what 49 other states do to organize human services, because we could all learn something from the experiments of other states and how they've structured things. So I'm eager to learn from that.
Representative Keel.
Do you feel that you have better controls over the different departments in this last, 160 days than was previous? I suppose that's a judgment call, but.
Beginning to. We're putting, as I mentioned, we put several things in place where we're centralizing controls under Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson. We're telling our whole department that we are going to dot I's and cross T's now. And people are embracing that and starting to learn that. Our process control people are moving about the department and showing them how their processes work. And we're all learning about that. Our own compliance department, which is a separate group, has been around talking to people about their biggest long-term risks, and people are beginning to identify those. So people are getting on the court, starting to have these conversations about process and control and risk. Some people are relieved that we're finally doing this, and there's things they've been concerned about that they're able to articulate now that to people that are listening. And people feel good that we're working to get things cleaned up. Nobody wants to repeat 2019 in the Department of Human Services. So I'm delighted with the early results of people embracing these procedures and getting into them. We still have a long way to go to studying all the processes in the department, getting everything lined up. But we're making the steps in the right direction, and we're not encountering resistance to do that. So I'm pleased with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of comments and then a question. I want to just note how lucky we are to have somebody of your caliber, Commissioner, doing this work. And I think this presentation is really impressive, and the work that you've been doing. I'm so glad to have you in this position. My particular area of focus has been in the child care part of the work, and I really want to commend members to the presentation that we had from Commissioner Johnson on Thursday in the Early Childhood Committee. Representative Bonner and Representative Morrison were there talking about the Continuous Improvement Project, and really, really impressive stuff in terms of the program integrity for the Child Care Assistance Program and other programs as well, and just some really impressive work kind of showing what the process was before and some challenges there, and that same team that did that work was the team that had addressed the health facilities area, the elder care area in the Department of Health, I believe, yeah, and done incredible work. And so if folks still have questions on the Child Care Assistance Program and program integrity there, I would really urge you to watch that presentation and meet with the team. I'm sure they'd be eager to, because I think it gave some really strong reassurance to us. I know in the Senate as well that they've had really a lot of praise to give as well. My question just connects with the departmental structure issue, and it's a little bit different angle. I think we may have spoken about this individually as well. I'm interested on the early childhood side, the fact that you've got early care and learning programs spread across multiple departments, which is a somewhat different point, but the fact that programs that are helping to support care and learning for young kids and child care assistance are in DHS, and yet through the early learning scholarships, through pre-kindergarten, et cetera, Department of Education. And so I guess just if you've had any further thoughts as you're exploring this, I know it's early, but as to whether that particular set of programs, whether there's something that might make some sense around having kind of similar goals being accomplished in multiple places.
Chair Moran and Representative, there have been some suggestions that we combine more things than just break things up. That's true. I guess I would say right now that I am pleased with the progress of the children's cabinet that the governor's office has put together to attempt to get us to work across lines on his intense focus on children and families. And that's not just a window dressing or a chart on the wall. It's really happening. And we've been together, many of us commissioners, talking about children and how our services and processes interact with each other. So I think that intense focus and that structure are going to be useful and helpful in bringing things together like that. We also have housing services in different places, employment services in different places, and so these interagency task forces are a way for us to bring all of that together. The Interagency Task Force on Homelessness has also brought a couple of ideas together for this session that intersect lines and go across different departments. So for now, I think that's the best way to approach those, and I'm optimistic that that will produce results.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe just to follow up, I know that in some states they've moved to have, whether it's a department of early learning, early care and learning, early childhood, et cetera, and then in some states there's been some moves that way. We'll have to, of course, see as our different departments and see where the process you've described lays out. So I guess I'll just toss out to you as something to at least keep in mind. But I agree the Children's Cabinet work that I've seen from the outside has been really impressive and certainly shows a commitment by you and your fellow commissioners and the governor, lieutenant governor in that area. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, commissioners, sincerely thank you for what you are doing and for stepping into an extraordinarily difficult situation. That is not lost, I think, probably on anyone at this table. So we do appreciate that. And in spite of that, we have hard questions. So I think I have some frustration. My colleagues have some frustration. More importantly, my constituents have significant frustration. After seeing the mistakes happening at DHS over these past years, the concern is that DHS is not being held accountable for these mistakes, and instead, these mistakes are being passed on to the taxpayer, whether it is the tribes being asked to repay for the mistakes of DHS, whether it's the county being asked to repay for the mistakes made by DHS. I even heard over the weekend that their employees who have been misclassified during a promotion, they are being asked to repay thousands of dollars in salary that they've received. I spoke to my county just this morning and was told that they have been billed. They're starting to be billed for the mistakes that go back all the way to 2014. And again, those mistakes were made by DHS, not the counties. And while we're not asking for money from the legislature, that money is coming from my constituents, from the taxpayers within my county. My question is, how is DHS taking responsibility for these mistakes? And how can we as a legislature do a better job of holding DHS accountable?
Commissioner Hofstadt.
Thank you, Chair Moran, Representative. First of all, on a couple of the areas you're talking about, the tribal payments and the county payments, those were federal dollars. And we're required by law to recover them if we've overpaid them. And so that's the short answer to the whole question. When it comes to federal dollars, we're required to recover. So we have already begun to invoice, correct the claims and invoice the counties. And we have a meeting set up later this week with the White Earth Nation and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwa to get on the phone with us, with CMS, to get a final determination from CMS about the nature of those payments. After that, we would have then to send the tribes a letter asking them to repay those. They have a chance to appeal that to administrative law judge who could make a decision about it. And then we run out of a lot of options. And so we need to correct the state budget in some way from these errors, and we don't have a lot of pathways. There's nothing really in state statute that tells us how to fix these errors when they happen. And so we're left having to solve the problems together and digging in and trying to find a path for them.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you currently have a path to, I mean, let's be honest, we know that there are a lot of programs, there are a lot of dollars that are changing hands. How can you, as DHS, work to make the tribes and counties whole?
Commissioner Hofstadt.
Chair Moran, Representative, the tribes have the, we're calling CMS to see if there's any federal solution. Then there's this judicial potential path, we'll try that. And then there's the possibility for the legislature to appropriate dollars and pay the dollars back. And then we don't have very good options other than a very long-term payment plan on the administrative side of the house. The counties have the same path, but they don't have the judicial path just because of the nature of the dollars and the payments that we're talking about. And those are the choices in terms of how we make the budget and the forecast work in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're saying that in order to make them whole, it would require legislative action to direct the Department of Human Services to find those dollars and make them whole.
On the side of the tribes, not if the law judge says not to recover the money, and then the legislature does not have to appropriate the dollars. And then if the federal government surprises us with a different decision than they've made before, then that would not be an appropriation. So there's a couple of other paths, but the legislature certainly is one of them on both sides of that.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for coming. Obviously, you've had a difficult situation. Here's what I'm hearing. You know, if we look at what has been misused, misspent, it totals to be about $160 million, give or take. We have $30 million going to tribes, $70 million overpayment for chemical dependency, and 3.7 payments to deceased Medicaid enrollments, and another $50 million for grants and contracts that didn't have proper documentation. So my two questions is, what have you discovered as the commissioner that caused this problem? And what are we going to do to our customers, which is the taxpayers? Because obviously this is a lot of money. I know, you know, this is a huge amount of money for people. So what, why did this happen? Because obviously you jumped in there. I'm assuming you dug deep, not just here, like, okay, we got to dug deep to find out what the problem was. And then what are we going to do to prevent this from happening? Because I know if I ran an organization like this, like a business, there would be people probably put me in jail. So I just want to know, those are my two questions, please. Thank you.
Chair Moran and Representative, the cause of the problems I already have mentioned here, and that is soft process controls. That's the issue in the department that caused these things. Most of these decisions were made by people who are no longer in the department. And so when people are not given the tools they need to do their jobs properly, that is the issue that mm-hmm. we've run into here. And so the solution, as I've said, is to tighten up these process controls. So going forward, when a decision is questioned like this years later, we can go back and say, here are the three people that signed off on that on this date. And from now on, our CFO is not going to write checks for new payment decisions until they see those three signatures on the right form, so that everything is buttoned up and documented and signed by the right people.
Okay, Representative Backer.
And thank you. So two things there. So did you then, because obviously DHS is a monster organization, huge. So was there an audit done, a third-party agency that came out to dig into it, you know, and to get a third-party opinion? Because obviously agency itself is skewed. the people are going to protect their hides because, you know, if they made overpayment, they want to protect their hide. We don't want another state agency to do it necessarily. But an independent, did someone do an audit? And then you're talking about changing process controls. Can you be a little bit more specific on that? Because at the end of the day, if we're just changing process, but if there is not recourse, meaning disciplining actions, and I don't know the people who resigned. I have a really hard time that there's only five people, and I'm not saying you're implying it, but other people have implied that, well, these are the people who caused the problem. To me, this is a systematic organization, and I'm going to be bold, arrogance, okay? And that, I'm not saying under your control, but beforehand. Because I have talked to county government. I represent seven counties, five total, two and a half. And sometimes they just say it's like hitting their wall against DHS and so forth. So first question deals with, was there internal audit? If not, why not on that third party? And then number two, when you talk about process controls, can you be more specific, please?
Commissioner Hoffman.
Thank you, Chair Moran. Representative, so if you look at the list of things that were discovered in 2019, you probably remember the Office of the Legislative Auditor did an audit on the tribal overpayments, a pretty exhaustive analysis back to the beginning. The overpayments to deceased beneficiaries came out of a federal audit, okay, where we discovered that problem. Several of the other issues were just brought forward by the department as we were discovering the original problems last year. Somebody noticed another problem and brought that forward. And then some of them were suspicions that we had in our internal audit department, investigated those and brought them forward. But we brought everything forward, and we've laid it out and said, here's what happened, and here's what's going on, and here's what we need to do now to fix them. Process controls can be very simple things, as I think they will be in this situation, like having the right people sign off on decisions. So for example, our Community Supports Administration and our Children and Families Division are handling more federal dollars than they used to. Over in our Healthcare Administration, we have people with greater expertise in Medicaid and CMS policy. And those two departments both need to sign off on payment decisions before our CFO will start to write the checks. And we had some situations where people made the decision within their department on their best knowledge, but not with a second signature from the Healthcare Administration. Going forward, they'll both have to sign off before the CFO, a third person, will start to write checks. And that's how you put process control in place.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Hupstadt. I want to say thank you for being here today. I very much appreciate the work that you've been bringing and your business expertise to the Department of Human Services. A couple things I wanted to touch on a little bit and get a little bit know more about is over the years I've had a lot of ability to work with DHS on the ground level in the homeless youth world. And one of the things I've always been impressed with is the department's ability to get to yes when things got very tight. We've got a lot of small agencies that do the same thing, a lot of nonprofits that are out there servicing the true customers out there, our most vulnerable people, whether they're seniors, whether they're kids, whether they're disabled, and making sure that things are being done so that the services and the dollars that are needed to run these programs and take care of our people out there are happening effectively. I've also spent many years in the private sector working for a company that was, the last company I worked for was recognized as top 10 in the country for being service-oriented. And one of the things that we learned when being service-oriented and carrying out things to the people was making sure is how do we focus on getting to yes to take care of our clients out there while keeping controls in there. Because sometimes we found when you put controls in, people can get so focused on the controls that they forget about the service that we ultimately have to provide. And something that I've seen that the department has always done very well with the groups and the populations and the vulnerable populations we've worked with over time. So the challenge you have, how do you tie that together to make sure that the customers who are most vulnerable in our state are still getting the services that they need?
Commissioner Hoffman.
Thank you, Chair Moran. Representative, I had some of this experience at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. As we started there, a well-run organization when I got there, But as I became COO, for example, we had a fellow who became the chief financial director at the same time, not the CFO, but a senior finance director. And as we were asking people to imagine their biggest possibilities for the people we serve, he was putting in place quarterly forecasting, key performance indicators, and several other kinds of controls to sharpen up our ability to handle our budgets and to make sure that we always came in on budget and did well. And the two together was a really great balance. What we found in the beginning was people who came to serve their neighbor concerned that now it's all about the money and not the mission. So we listened to that for a few years. And then as we got those controls in place and they became second nature, and this is just how you do your job, over time people realized, wait a minute, I'm spending all my time on the mission now because I haven't been to an emergency budget session in the last 10 years. And so I think they can go together very nicely, and when people come to the department to serve their neighbor, as I mentioned, we have other people like computer programmers and compliance people and CFOs and financial people who like to button things up and make sure processes and systems work well. And so I think by just finding a better balance, we'll get the department humming in a way that these processes just become how you do your job, second nature, so people can spend their mental and energy and on the reasons they came to the department. One of the reasons I asked people to imagine their three-year biggest possibilities was so we can keep our eye on 3 years from now when these controls are in place and we're not like right here looking at today's newspaper, but we're looking out there, what we're trying to cause. And if we can put those processes and systems under them and shore up their jobs so that they can do that, I think we'll have a good balance. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, you started with soft around the edges. That's hard to do, to say, I imagine. I got to commend you for your transparency of your department. To come to us and say that the number was really $106 million, that's hard. And that's being honest with us. And I appreciate that because that tells us really where we're at. But also you came back to us and said you found $94 million. And back payments that was owed to us. And so I have to commend you. I am, as a freshman, I am totally impressed with what you've done in the short time you've done it. And I really hope other departments within the state, our boards such, use your model of management and transparency. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Nice to see you again. I also thank you for your hard work. As we discussed when you met with me in my office, which I appreciate your time very much, you have the hardest job in the state, and I don't think any of us envy you, but we are grateful for how hard you're working on righting the ship, and we want to be good partners in that. But I do have a couple more questions. I know I'm only allowed one, so I'll start with one, but I hope to get back a second chance. I have two different tacks. I'm not sure which to go. Okay, so at the finance hearing, we attended the finance hearing that was held in December, and at that time, then Representative Zerwas, our former colleague, asked you about whether you would support an audit. Like Governor Walz had said on Almanac, he did support a full external audit, and I know we've had a little discussion about that, but it seems like some of you said there was no financial problems, it's a process problem, but I believe, and I may be wrong, but I believe that the overpayments to the deceased people came about through a financial audit from the federal government. Is that correct? So I'm a little confused of why you don't think of, or would you, because the governor also supports it, would you support still a financial full audit top to bottom? Because I think it's great the progress you've made. I really do salute you for that. But I feel like, you know, we've continued to even have these small things come to light. And I think just a comprehensive top to bottom full audit, get it all out of the way so we could rebuild more effectively. As you're talking about a three-year plan maybe to get this all in place, it just feels like maybe we're missing the boat by not doing this really comprehensive review before you start making saying we're going to be done in 3 years.
Commissioner Hofstadter.
Yes, Chair Moran, Representative. The federal audit that found the payments to deceased, to on behalf of deceased beneficiaries, to MCOs, not to deceased beneficiaries, was a processed audit like the others. They discovered that we have, again, legacy systems that don't all talk to each other, and we weren't finding out as quickly as we would like when a beneficiary was deceased to stop the payment. Just as an aside, we announced that because we were announcing everything that we found in the fall, but our payment accuracy to those beneficiaries was 99.98%, even though we did find some payments on behalf of deceased beneficiaries. So it wasn't a financial audit. It wasn't about our generally accepted accounting principles or our budgeting or passing an annual financial audit. I know the governor has said he's open to audits. He doesn't mind people coming in and taking a look, making sure that people can come in and audit us, internal audit, the OLA, federal audits, bring them on, I think was his overall comment. I asked someone in the department one day, because people had started talking about comprehensive audits, what it would take to audit the whole department. I think you all know that when a company is audited every year, auditors take a sample of some of the services or some of the products and audit a sample of things every year. Some folks in our department, just off the top of their heads and trying to imagine it, we're imagining it would take four auditors 10 years to do a complete full audit of every service in the Department of Human Services. So I think we will always be in a mode of doing occasional audits. Some of the federal audits have come about because the federal government was auditing its own systems, and so they'd go out and check seven states and see how things looked and then find something. And that's how those come about. Our internal auditor often goes to do an audit inside the department because an employee has come forward and said, I think we might have made a mistake here, and then they'll go do an internal audit. As you know, you have access to the legislative auditor who can go in and look at something that you're concerned about. But I think it's probably going to continue to stay in that realm because a comprehensive bottoms up to top audit of the entire department is a near impossibility.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I understand that. So would it, as part of sort of our legislative oversight duties, is there a way that perhaps we could require sort of a annualized look at one section, and so that, you know, every year or every 4 years or every 10 years or whatever, every section of the department is getting reviewed so that we have confidence that this isn't just a temporary Band-Aid under your leadership, that things have changed, but that there will be ongoing expectations of proper processes that outlast you.
Commissioner Hofstadt.
Chairman and Representative, I suppose we could have that conversation. You could have the conversation with the legislative auditor as well. What we're doing is working to fix these processes going forward. It doesn't keep a federal audit from coming in, going back to 2014 and continuing to find problems. And so I don't know where to draw that line exactly or how to, you know, design an annual regular system that's going to look at everything over time. But it's something you could discuss.
And forgive me, I'm sorry.
One moment. I want to speak a little bit to that. Because often for myself, when we look at departments and making sure they are proficient, a lot of times I'm able to see like the staff and employees within those departments. And what I have encountered from many of the staffs when we see these crises is that the morale of the staff become toxic. Everyone seems to believe that it's not just not an audit, it's an attack on them, and whether or not their job would be secure or whether they would be the next person to let go. And so I think sometimes in the legislative we have over-police, and that over-policing have had like a really negative effect on the morale of those who are working for the state, who come to the state to really do great work. And so I just wanted to share that because I don't know if you guys ever have contact with folks who are working for the state and how they feel about being an employee of the state. And so I just wanted to just share that a little bit about, Robin. Representative Robbins.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I think the conversations and the questions that have been posed to you have been relegated to, as you said, process. But I'm reminded from the first State of the State when Governor Walz suggested that the tone of the agencies needed to be reflective of more of a model that focused on humility for the services provided. And to your point, Chair Moran, I think that when we don't put that at the focus of an agency. I think what propagates itself is organizational laziness, to your point about soft around the edges. I think sometimes, though, when we talk about soft around the edges, we don't diagnose the underlying concern or diagnosis for what's going on. So to the extent that processes act as a Band-Aid, I think sometimes soft around the edges probably requires more draconian diagnoses and procedures to fix what's ailing an organization. I think, as you and I have shared openly, I think there's a skepticism towards your agency by the people that candidly work in county government, that receive services at the county level, in any of the sovereign communities, for the communication. I trust that that's being repaired, or that it's been reflective of more of a humbleness rather than defensive in terms of this is the way it's always done, just go with the flow, because it is about culture. And culture begets trust, or it doesn't. And if you don't have a culture that speaks to personal accountability, then you've got rot inside the apple. So I have a question with regard to culture, and then a follow-up, if you will, Chair Moran. So, you know, we've had and talked about a number of instances in the last few months where DHS employees, I'll use the word blatantly, violated state law. The biggest of those, of course, was the $52 million awarded without proper documentation. Reported to DHS that they knew they were breaking the law. Additionally, OLAs found, you know, tribal organizations report DHS violated Minnesota Official Records Act by not documenting who decided to pay tribes for the encounters that didn't occur. So my first question culturally is, and the accountability that comes out of a culture in an organization is, so what penalties do you think there should be for state employees that violate state law?
Commissioner Hartsey.
Chairman Moran, Representative. First of all, in terms of some of the decisions that have been raised and brought forward, the people that made them are no longer with the department. Because as mentioned, some of these go back many, many years. So they're... those folks aren't with us today, and we need to fix the process. When it comes to the 16A violations, I think that's what you're talking about. You're talking about the department saying it broke the law. I am still struggling as a commissioner to figure out what to do with the statute that allows us, when a provider jumps the gun and starts the work before they sign the contract, to go back to the day one of service and pay the provider, but allow the person who signs it to be on the front page of the paper saying they've broken the law. I'm not sure what to do with that process. Obviously, it was intended to deal with specific situations, again, often around July 1st when everything gets stood up. When a provider jumps the gun and starts the service, it gives the grace to the provider to go back and be paid for day one of service, but it's called a violation of the law by the staff employee who signs it. An alternative is to not sign it, not file them, not tell anyone that we did that. So I'm proud of the department for signing the 16A forms and coming forward and saying this was a violation. We've been working on training our people to use that process much less often, because it's just the thicket of difficulty to get engaged with that and to either get their act together ahead of time or to not let people start, or to not allow people to be paid back to day one of service. So we're trying to get ourselves away from using that. But when it has occurred, I'm proud that the department has signed those forms and filed them and admitted that we had those jump starts like that. So again, if we had found someone who had deliberately not followed direction, not done their job, was not in a position where we thought they could do their job going forward, we'd have done something about that. That's not been the case in each of these things that we have found in 2019 so far, anyway.
Thank you, Chair Moran. So as a follow-on to that, I want to just point you to this slide in your deck. It talks about supporting employees and building culture. Mm-hmm. And you talk about an employee vision statement, which is yet to come. I would certainly like to understand and hear your thoughts in terms of how long that will take and the rollout on that. But more to the point in terms of my question, follow-up, is in the last bullet point on that slide, you talk about a collaborative safety model. Mm-hmm. Tough on process, supportive and encouraging to people. Mm-hmm. Help me understand how that is reflective of going forward when you have folks like Dr. Schiff and Ms. Bernstein who brought forward concerns to their superiors. Hopefully they came to your attention or your predecessors. And yet they were continued to be ostracized, deflected, and ultimately terminated for observing irregularities or outright violations in the regulatory environment in which the members of DHS were supposed to abide by. So help me understand how those compare and contrast with an organization that has 7,000 people, seven layers of middle management. You can hide within that organization as it stands today for a long time. How do you go about creating an effective collaborative safety model?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Harfstad.
Chair Moran, Representative, I was, Dr. Schiff was gone before I came, so I can't speak to that situation. Ms. Bernstein has not been terminated. She's still with us. She's been moved to a new position in our compliance department, actually. Where she continues to do her good work. Last summer, when some of these issues were raised, we opened an anonymous hotline for employees to come forward and safely report errors. And the internal audit report we released just 2 weeks ago was the result of that, where employees came forward and talked about problems that they think they saw in the department. You may have read that there were nine problems that were identified. About half of those were substantiated and half were not. And the internal audit report ended with a list of recommendations we could do to tighten up controls in those areas, and we're implementing every one of those recommendations. So the collaborative safety model was at work when employees felt that they could come forward in an anonymous way and say there were problems, be listened to, and have us respond by saying we're going to implement every one of those recommendations. Thank you for coming forward. And so as we continue to train our staff on the collaborative safety model, again, it's merely a way to analyze a problem, get to the root of it, and solve the problem instead of immediately blaming a person. And I think it's doing a good job for us, and it's causing a good culture. But you're right. This is as much about culture as it is about analytical process control. And so we're working now to build a culture of greater trust, a culture of people feeling safe to come forward. I've asked three of our labor unions to work with me to help us develop a culture of safety where people feel that they can come forward and say when they find a problem. They've seen us this year announcing our own problems to the press, and then the collaborative safety model explains how that works. So I think it's all in service of creating a very healthy culture where people can come forward and say, I think I saw something here that doesn't square. We should take a look at this. And our compliance department, our audit department, our finance department have been responsive to those things coming forward and have dealt with them. So that's the kind of culture we are trying to develop along with our process controls.
All right. So, members, we have 10 minutes left of this committee hearing. We have four members on the list: Liebling, Morrison, Schultz, and Robbins. Is there anyone else who would like to speak? And are we okay if we go a little bit over? Okay. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't realize this went by very quickly. I just want to respond to a few things that I have heard here. It's not so much a question. First of all, Representative Backer made the statement he'd be in jail if he did some of these things. I just want to point out that there is nothing here that indicates any kind of fraud or dishonesty within the Department of Human Services. Nothing. I mean, sometimes we don't really keep perspective on our own state, but, you know, if you look around the country, you see a lot of headlines, you know, governors go to jail, people embezzle, talking about within state government. There's none of that here. So we just need to keep that in perspective. Not to say that overpayments aren't bad and so on, but these are mistakes. These are failures of systems. These are not employees stealing from government. So I think we need to make that very clear. A number of things have been said. There was some talk about audits by the OLA or audits. Can't we audit the department? You know, the OLA actually does an audit. I think it's every year. This is the single, what do they call it? The single audit?
Federal audit?
The single what?
Federal audit.
The single federal audit. The OLA, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, does an audit on behalf of the federal government. I think it's federally required. And these are all published. They're online. They do this every single year. And as the commissioner noted, they sample because that's the way to do it. But there are audits going on. And then the OLA, as everybody knows, does spot audits. And they've done quite a bit of auditing. So there, that is going on. You know, going back to this thing, Representative Albright, you said these employees knew they were breaking the law. I think the commissioner explained this, but I just want to make sure that people understand that I think the law kind of says two things that are a little bit in conflict here. So the law says you've got to have a signed contract with a vendor before they start the work. But then if the vendor, there's also a process in law, and that's what I understand this 16A thing is, that allows for what do you do if that can't happen? So that's what this process is in law, and the employees were using this process because they couldn't get all the signatures in time, and if you use this other process, it allows that vendor to be paid from when they actually started the work. So it's kind of, is it breaking the law? Well, the law allows this process that they were using. It's not the ideal process, and the commissioner has mentioned that there are some things she maybe would like us to change so that they could more easily actually have the stuff signed in the beginning. But it's not people breaking the law. I just want to be really clear about that because that kind of talk, you know, if I was working at DHS, I think I'd feel kind of demoralized by the way they get talked about here sometimes because we have wonderful employees who work very, very hard. Most of them, I mean, there are a lot of employees. You can't generalize. But I would say that, you know, things work pretty well considering the complexity and the enormous amount of money that goes through and all of those things. So can we tighten it up? Absolutely. I'm so glad the commissioner is working on these things. But I just want us to be really careful that we're not just bashing, you know, not that anyone here is bashing the department, but we want to not do that because, you know, all of us here want them to do different things. Those of us who've been here a while, we put forward a plan, we want a program, we want something to happen. And it's very hard to manage all of this. So, you know, I know we're kind of short on time, but I just want to say that, you know, if you look at this list on the slide of the things that happened, the overpayment issues, you know, I really wanted to ask, you know, like the question that's kind of out there was the one that Representative New asked some time ago, which is, you know, how should the department be held accountable? I guess I'd like to ask, maybe offline, because there's no time now, I'd like to know what Representative New or any of the members think accountability should be. What does that mean to you? Because I'm kind of struggling with that, frankly. The department is not like a bad child that you can slap its hand, right? It works for us. The money that it has come from the taxpayers of Minnesota or federally, you know, a lot of federal money. I mean, yes, we want to hold people accountable. Absolutely we do. But we have these situations where somebody has to pay. And I don't know if members are thinking, cut the budget of DHS to hold them accountable. I'd like to know if that's what you're looking for. I really would. And if so, what would you cut? Because if we just say, oh, we're going to take the money out of DHS's budget, that means DHS has to stop doing something that we're telling them to do. You know, that's kind of how it works. So I would really sincerely like members to come to me and tell me what you think accountability looks like and what you would like to see happen in terms of some of these overpayment issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Commissioner Harbstead. Your transparency and equanimity in answering our questions about the challenges at DHS is impressive and admirable. The state of Minnesota is very lucky to have you in this role. Thank you. My question is about MFIP. You referenced its historic increase in your remarks, and I'm wondering if you could talk more about some of the stories you've heard from some of the beneficiaries and how it's impacting their lives.
Commissioner Hofstede.
Yes, Chair Moran and Representative mentioned a few of them a little bit, but I talked to a group of all women that particular day who were telling me about how they were able to use MFIP for a short time between jobs in order to continue working toward their next job to improve their lives and their families' lives. I heard people talking about how MFIP enabled them to finish school so that they could then go on and get an even better job and be able to support their families in a better way. I had a woman who came with one of her professors from Metro State who'd been a mentor of hers and was proud of her, and they told a story together about how she was able to keep working while she went to Metro State and make all of the ends meet with a little bit of help from MFIP for a short period of time. So I found them to be brave and resilient people who, with a little bit of help from the rest of us, were able to lift themselves into a new position in their lives where they could take care of their families better. It was really quite inspiring. The additional $100 doesn't go very far. It's not very much, but it's a little bit more, and and every dollar can count for people in their situation. And I hope we continue to look at ways to provide a little bit of support like that to neighbors who can use it like that to move their own lives and their own families forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Moran. So organizations are about people, and I'm just curious, you've served in the private sector, the nonprofit sector, and now you're serving in state government. Do you lack any tools that you need to, one, like reward employees or give merit-based pay or to retain really good, solid employees or other tools you need to change the culture, which I know is really difficult to do? So based on your experience in the different sectors, what tools are you missing that you wish you had?
Thank you, Chair Moran and Representative. I'd have to think about that for a while, so I may reserve the right to get back to you after I think about that longer. But I am also impressed with the tools we have available in state government. For example, I started my new staff and my new team together with only one person yet to hire, and we used the Strength Finder to compare our strengths and understand what kind of a team we have. And MMB has access to that tool and has people that train us on how to use it. And so I didn't have to go outside and hire an outside consultant to come in. Again, my biggest delight of the fall was that I had green and black belts in Six Sigma quality right in the department. I didn't have to go hire Accenture or Deloitte to come in and take a look at the department and tell us what to do, which would have been difficult to do because they would have lacked the credibility and we would have had to convince everyone that this might work. But we have the Lean Six Sigma quality control process in the department. It's already proven itself over and over again in state government. So I knew it was the right tool to use going forward. We simply said, okay, now we'll just apply that process to these payment decisions and let's clean that up too. And they were able to go right and do that. Don't get me started on legacy information systems. There's never enough in any state government, as I compare notes with people in other parts of the country, to have the sharpest, fastest, most up-to-date systems, and so that's always a challenge. We continue to keep working away to fix and improve and patch and fix again the systems that we do have to work with. And I'm a little concerned that if we were to throw it all out and start all over, we'd have all the new system problems. And so I'd kind of like to just keep working on the ones we have instead of starting over. So I think we're in fairly good shape. I think culturally we've got the management team that I was looking to put in place that has background in managing people, and I think they'll already have a salutary effect on the people that work for them. As we build our team together, I think we have plenty of opportunity to set the culture the way we want. I'm excited about a whole group of employees that are working right now on our employee vision statement about how would you like it to be to work here in the department. I've also taken a look through our HR department at the management training that we offer frontline supervisors. I think we owe every person who comes in every day to work for us a great manager. And I want to be sure that our frontline supervisors are getting all the training that they need to be great managers. I'm excited that Dr. Karen McKinney has joined us to help us with an entire Department of Human Services systematic approach to examining our own biases and developing our intercultural competence because of the number of people that we serve that we need to understand and better appreciate. So I think we're in fairly good shape right now. Thank you very much. If you could double or triple or quadruple the systems budget, that'd be great. short of that, I think we're in fairly good shape. Thanks.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, everyone else has already said it, but thank you, Commissioner Harpstead, for being here and giving us some more background and more information. Certainly an approach that we're going to need moving forward as again, that trust needs to continue to be built up. And I guess the thing that concerns me the most is in hearing even the response from Chair Liebling, the fact that they're wanting the accountability and wanting that to kind of come forward. I guess the concerning question for me is when employees are retaliated against for calling out issues within the department and losing their job over those types of activities. But they're let go, but people are not let go when all these millions of dollars are overpaid and all this mismanagement of funds has occurred. Those are truly ways of making people accountable, and I think that we have to acknowledge that they demoted or retrained or something has to be done. And if it is just a systems problem, great, but ultimately, systems are about people too, and we needed to do a better job with that. And I guess I'm just concerned that cultural lack of accountability is still in existence. I'm grateful and heard. I was listening to your comments very closely and heard you say about the hotline and things like that are somewhat assuring to me. But ultimately, the buck stops with you is what I was reading in the remarks too and the PowerPoint, and we can't just keep passing it. We really have to have the ability to hold people accountable, and I think to Representative New's point, that's something that we need to continue to look towards, and I guess that was my main comment.
Representative Pearson, I believe I heard a commissioner say that no one was fired or let go. Okay. That individual that we have called the whistleblower is still working at DHS. She has moved into another department where expertise can be utilized best. But I would let the commissioner also respond to that. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, that's correct, Chair Moran and Representative. No one has been let go for coming forward since I have come to DHS. And we don't intend to do that. And again, if in any of these situations, we could go back to one person who didn't do their job right or who made mistakes and deliberately ignored their training, we'd have disciplined them. And we have yet to find a situation that one of these payment issues goes back to a person who required discipline because of the actions that they took. And again, if we don't give people the right tools to be sure they're making good decisions and that decisions are documented and double-checked with the right people, then disciplining them doesn't solve anything. So,
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, and I'll try to be brief. I just wanted to say I was a part of some of the testimony from Commissioner Johnson the other day, talking about some of the issues, particularly with early childhood. And this will be a little bit telling, being an Agile practitioner, but the inner geek in me was very excited about all of the Lean Six Sigma processes that you went through. And for those who are unaware, this is a really deep, intensive dive into the processes and procedures and the roles of each individual person at each and every step of the way and how we make those the most efficient that they can be. But one of the things we kept talking about today that I didn't hear, so I just wanted to bring that forward, is that a big part of that process is about the actual people and how they can best be empowered to do their job, to have the tools that they need to do the right thing when they need to do it. And that's a huge component in the Lean Six Sigma process. So I am very excited, and all of those fantastic charts that documented all of that, that is my world. So thank you for all of that. I'm really appreciative of that. And that leads me to sort of towards my question. So I realize that that helps us build strong, high-functioning teams, and that is fantastic. And one of the things that we did see out of that was that they were starting to finally be able to put together sort of a series of metrics, even within their own areas of expertise, that they could use to start gauging how they were doing and how they were progressing, which was, and some of those statistics were actually quite impressive. And I'm curious, I think I assume I know the answer, but I'm hoping that there is a similar process to develop some of those metrics in all of the other areas outside of just the childhood area. And if you could maybe speak to that and what that looks like so that they can kind of help measure their progress and keep moving forward and give us some helpful items on lessons they've learned and where they've come.
Thank you very much, Chair Moran and Representative. Absolutely. The same team that did the Lean Six Sigma approach on child care payments is looking at all of our payments, and we'll go through the same process, and we'll develop a set of metrics at the end that we can continue to look at to see how we're making progress and how we're doing. I also just wanted to refer back to the fact that now that the 90-day plan has become the 90-day report, which is now the 160-day report, we have the ongoing advisory panel who will be continuing to look at our process improvement every month this year. And so our process improvement team will be reporting to them next month on what they've discovered so far, how they're putting their process together, how they've diagrammed the process, and where they're taking it next. And so we'll have that ongoing approach. We'd be welcome to come back as often as you like to hearings and show you what we're doing and how it's coming and the metrics that we're using to show you that we're getting things buttoned up. One simple metric we can all look to is how the department, the direct care and treatment programs were in blazing headlines 3 years ago and haven't been so much in the last year. The same process was used over at MNsure, which was in blazing headlines 4 years ago, hasn't been so much now. And so you can see how these things have settled down with good process control and why I'm confident that that will also happen with our payment scheme. So thanks for asking.
Thank you. Okay. The last person to myself would be Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two-part. First of all, I appreciate Representative Moran, you talking about the morale of employees. I think that is a big deal, particularly with the unrest that's been going on. And frankly, I've been hearing from a lot of sort of rank-and-file employees, and there is some pretty significant concern there. And to be honest, I've been told to keep digging, that the problems really have not been resolved. one tool that I know has been used among the rank and file employees to make sure that their voices have been heard is that they do these, what do they call them? A union meet and confer mm-hmm. meeting. Have you been attending those and have you been able to get some feedback from your employees via those meetings? I know that's something that typically commissioners do.
Some, not regularly, not every quarter. But again, I've also recently asked the leadership of our three major unions to help me think about ways to make the department a safe place for people to come forward and help us think about better ways to make sure that employees know that from now on, not just this year, that they should come forward when they see issues and bring them forward and that activity will be rewarded as opposed to punished. And they've all agreed to do that. So I'm eager for that conversation. I would also like to see our brand new managers and the people we continue to train to be great managers to continue to develop a dialogue, an ongoing dialogue with employees. So they're all looking at ways to make things better. As our process control people move through our departments and teach them these new processes, they're all talking about what's going on in the department. We're expecting that process to come uncover potential other issues that we may discover in the department. So stay tuned for how that might stir some things up that we also need to take a look at. And so there's several different directions that we're coming at this from to make sure people know that from now on, you should feel free to come forward at DHS when you see an issue and bring it forward. I think 2019 was a watershed year for the department. It may or may not have been comfortable to bring things forward before that. I can't speak to that. But when they saw us put all the laundry on the line in 2019 and then have an internal audit that took all of their concerns and put them into a set of recommendations that we're going to implement and people actually rewarded for their bringing forward the ideas, I think you'll see a different department culture going forward as a result of that. And I know that the pressure we were under last year from the press and from all the scrutiny made it a very difficult year for employees. And so you may still be seeing or hearing remnants of that. But I hear it getting better all the time. And I think as we go forward, it'll just continue to improve as we go. And I think it'll be a new department as we go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. I would just encourage you that rather than just looking to the leadership of the unions and managers, those meet and confer meetings are a really good opportunity. And I know commissioners have done that in the past for you to hear directly from those rank and file employees whose ideas, concerns, et cetera, may not be elevated through that process. And it gives you an opportunity to hear that. And I would just like to address Madam Chair, if I could, you know, I was asked relatively directly, what should accountability look like? And it is true. One of the very concerning things that we heard from the OLA report was that as they talked to employees and managers, one of their frustrations was that the vast majority of people they talked to would give a response that, well, I've only been in this position for 3 months or 6 months. I was in a different position before, so I don't know. And because of that, that creates an opportunity for a lack of accountability. And to be honest, to those of us who have deep, deep concerns about what is happening at the department, that looks very much like a shell game of employees moving around for the purpose of preventing accountability. And so I would encourage you to look at that issue and that problem and making sure that, I mean, to your point, systems are in place to be able to identify who is accountable at all times. That was a real frustration, I know, for the legislative auditor. And the other piece of that of this has to do with money, and that is very difficult, and I understand that. But the reality is Minnesotans do not want to be on the hook for the mistakes made by the department. And again, I understand, Commissioner, that these were not your mistakes either. These predate you, which makes it especially difficult to have to figure out the solution for things that have been happening for years. And again, I don't think anyone at this table minimizes the role that you are playing right now and what a challenge that is. But the bottom line is, yes, Minnesotans think that DHS should be held accountable, because right now, counties, that means residents, that means taxpayers in Minnesota across this state are now being held accountable. Not only did they pay for the initial programs, which we as Minnesotans have a long tradition of taking care of each other, and that is a good, positive thing, and we are willing to do that. But when we see our dollars wasted through mismanagement, fraud, et cetera, we don't want to pay for those mistakes. And my constituents are right now paying twice for these things that have happened at DHS. And that's not okay either. That's not okay either. You know, the department has been directed to find $100 million in savings. We've seen significant dollars go out in these programs via mismanagement and some via fraud. We know, particularly with the CCAP, which I appreciate, is you're making strides to clean that up as well. But the reality is, with a budget of billions of dollars, frankly, it's much more reasonable to ask the department to find those dollars than to place that burden back on counties that have significantly smaller budgets, and it wasn't their mistake. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, would you like to represent?
Yes, Chair Moran and Representative. First of all, I've been really clear that we were talking earlier about child care fraud and what we were doing to find child care fraud among child care providers. There's been no fraud found in the Department of Human Services, so I'd be really clear about that. And as Representative Liebling said earlier, if you want to take dollars out of the budget of the Department of Human Services, you'll have to tell us what services to stop providing, because the entire budget of the department was created by the legislature, asking us to do various things and us fiscal noting what it takes to do them and then putting that budget together. There's no simple solution in our state budgeting and forecasting process to fixing these problems. And we're going to have to talk about that, and we're going to need your help figuring it out.
Thank you. Well, Commissioner, I was going to ask you about the deregulation of child care, the PCA versus tight safety controls, but I can do that offline. And maybe Chair Pinto can also give me some information about what that means. But I just want to close by saying that, one, I just want to thank you for being here today. I have to just share with you all that I really have some tension about bringing you in back for the 90-day review. But I think having this 160-day review, looking back, looking at where we are, but also looking to the future about where we need to go, has been really, really helpful for all of us. I think over the years, we have looked at a DHS, we have looked at the culture of DHS, we have looked at the process. And we can look at even legislation that legislators have created that put pressure on DHS to perform in a certain way. And it's always been at a level where we got to do something because they felt like they were being under attack. I really appreciate your fresh look at how we need to make a department as big as DHS be functional, and to really put processes and accountabilities and oversight in looking at how it's not one person who is signing their name on a check, but we have some accountability on what that looks like. I think that's really important for a department like DHS, because of course we are here, the department's there to serve people. You know, if we're going to be a functional state in the legislature, I think one of the things we have to look at is the budget, right? But if we are cutting budget for everyday people, these are your constituents that we're trying to serve. And if there are ideas that we need to cut back, and that is going to help improve people's lives, I think we need to rethink how we're going to best serve people, children, the most vulnerable, the disability. And at the end of the day, you know, you stated under lessons from 2019, the question is, you said you were asked Minnesotans, but I'm going to say I will ask members to look at the department overall results. Overall, read the story of the lives supported with the tax dollars through DHS Works. And then let's make a fair judgment of the total picture that DHS has played in people's lives and the lives of people in the state of Minnesota. And so with that, I'm just going to end and say thank you for allowing us to hear your plan. And we are adjourned. Thank you.